I had to be sensitive so that I didn't make her feel bad or give her the impression that I thought she was poor. It makes me feel good knowing that I'm helping her have a better life.
Go out of your way to say hello to the most lonely person you know. Write a thank you note to someone who has made a difference in your life, like a friend, teacher, or coach. The next time you're at a toll booth, pay for the car behind you. Giving gives life, not only to others, but also to yourself. I love these lines from The Man Nobody Knows by Bruce Barton, which illustrate this point so well. There are two seas in Palestine. One is fresh, and fish are in it. Splashes of green adorn its banks. Trees spread their branches over it and stretch out their thirsty roots to sip of its healing waters. The River Jordan makes the sea with sparkling water from the hills, so it laughs in the sunshine, and men build their houses near to it, and the birds their nests, and every kind of life is happier because it is there. The River Jordan flows on south into another sea. There is no splash of fish, no fluttering leaf, no song of birds, no children's laughter. Travelers choose another route, unless on urgent business. The air hangs heavy above its water, and neither man nor beast nor fowl will drink. What makes this mighty difference in these neighbor seas? Not the River Jordan. It empties the same good water into both. Not the soil in which they lie. Not in the country round about. This is the difference. The Sea of Galilee receives, but does not keep the Jordan. For every drop that flows into it, another drop flows out. The giving and receiving go on in equal measure. The other sea is shrewder, hoarding its income jealously. It will not be tempted into any generous impulse. Every drop it gets, it keeps. The Sea of Galilee gives and lives. This other sea gives nothing. It is named the Dead. There are two kinds of people in this world. There are two seas in Palestine. Be gentle with yourself. Being gentle means many things. It means not expecting yourself to be perfect by tomorrow morning. If you're a late bloomer, and many of us are, be patient and give yourself time to grow. It means learning to laugh at the stupid things you do. I have a good friend, Chuck, who is extraordinary when it comes to laughing at himself and never taking life too seriously. I've always been amazed at how this hopeful attitude of his attracts friends by the score. Being gentle also means forgiving yourself when you mess up, and who hasn't done that? We should learn from our mistakes, but we shouldn't beat the tar out of ourselves over them. The past is just that, past. Learn what went wrong and why, make amends if you need to, then drop it and move on. Throw that voodoo doll out with the trash. One of the keys to happiness, says Rita Mae Brown, is a bad memory. A ship at sea for many years picks up thousands of barnacles that attach themselves to the bottom of the ship and eventually weigh it down, becoming a threat to its safety. Such a ship ultimately needs its barnacles removed, and the least expensive and easiest way is for the ship to harbor in a freshwater port free of salt water. Soon, the barnacles become loose on their own and fall off. The ship is then able to return to sea, relieved of its burden. Are you carrying around barnacles in the form of mistakes, regrets, and pain from the past? Perhaps you need to allow yourself to soak in fresh water for a while. Letting go of a burden and giving yourself a second chance may just be the deposit you need right now. Truly, learning to love yourself, as Whitney Houston sings, is the greatest love of all. Be honest. I looked up the word honest in my synonym finder the other day, and these are a few of the synonyms I found. Upstanding, incorruptible, moral, principled, truth-loving, steadfast, true, real, right, good, straight-shooting, genuine. Not a bad set of words to be associated with, don't you think? Honesty comes in many forms. First, there's self-honesty. Is what people see the genuine article, or do you appear through smoke and mirrors? I find that if I'm ever fake and try to be something I'm not, I feel unsure of myself and make a PBA withdrawal. I love how singer Judy Garland put it, always be a first-rate version of yourself instead of a second-rate version of somebody else. Then there's honesty in our actions. Are you honest at school, with your parents, and with your boss? If you've ever been dishonest in the past, and I think we all have, try being honest and notice how whole it makes you feel. Remember, you can't do wrong and feel right. The story by Jeff is a good example of that.
In my sophomore year, there were three kids in my geometry class who didn't do well in math. I was really good at it. I would charge them $3 for each test that I helped them pass. The tests were multiple choice, so I'd write on a little tiny piece of paper, all the right answers, and hand them off. At first I felt like I was making money. Kind of a nice job. I wasn't thinking about how it could hurt all of us. After a while, I realized I shouldn't do that anymore, because I wasn't really helping them. They weren't really learning anything, and it would only get harder down the road. Cheating certainly wasn't helping me.
It takes courage to be honest when people all around you are getting away with cheating on tests, lying to their parents, and stealing at work. But remember, every act of honesty is a deposit into your PBA and will build strength. As the saying goes, my strength is as the strength of 10 because my heart is pure. Honesty is always the best policy, even when it's not the trend. Renew yourself. You've got to take time for yourself to renew and to relax. If you don't, you'll lose your zest for life. You might be familiar with the movie The Secret Garden, based on the book of the same title. It's a story about a young girl named Mary who goes to live with her wealthy uncle after her parents are killed in an accident. Her uncle has become cold and withdrawn since the death of his wife several years earlier. In an effort to escape his past, he now spends most of his time traveling abroad. He has a son who is miserable, sickly, and confined to a wheelchair. The boy lives in a dark room in the vast mansion. After living in these depressing conditions for some time, Mary discovers a beautiful, overgrown garden nearby the mansion that has been locked up for years. Upon finding a secret entrance, she begins to visit the garden daily to escape her surroundings. It becomes her place of refuge, her secret garden. It's not long before she begins to bring her crippled cousin to the garden. The beauty of the garden seems to cast a spell on him, for he learns to walk again and regains his happiness. One day, Mary's withdrawn uncle, upon returning from a trip, overhears someone playing in the forbidden garden, and angrily rushes to see who it could be. To his surprise, he sees his son out of his wheelchair, laughing and frolicking in the garden. He is so overcome with surprise and joy that he bursts into tears and embraces his son for the first time in years. The beauty and magic of the garden brought this family together again. We all need a place we can escape to, a sanctuary of some sort, where we can renew our spirits, and it doesn't have to be a rose garden, or a mountaintop, or a beachfront. It can be a bedroom or even a bathroom, just a place to be alone. Theodore from Canada had his hideout.
Whenever I would get too stressed out, or when I was not getting along with my parents, I would just go into the basement. There I had a hockey stick, a ball, and a bare concrete wall, on which I could take out my frustrations. I would just shoot the ball for half an hour, and go back upstairs refreshed. It did wonders for my hockey game, but it was even better for my family relationships.
Arian told me about his refuge. Whenever he got too stressed out, he would slip into his high school's large auditorium through a back door. All alone in the quiet, dark, and spacious auditorium, he could get away from all the bustle, have a good cry, or just relax. Allison found a garden all her own.
My dad died in an industrial accident at work when I was little. I don't really know the details because I've always been afraid to ask my mother very many questions about it. Maybe it's because I have created a perfect picture of him in my mind that I don't want to change. To me, he is this perfect human being who would protect me if he was here. He is with me all the time in my thoughts, and I imagine how he would act and help me if he was here. When I really need him, I go to the top of the slide at the local grade school playground. I have this silly feeling that if I can go up to the highest place, I will be able to feel him. So I climb up to the top of the slide and just lie there. I talk to him in my thoughts, and I can feel him talking to my mind. I want him to touch me, but of course know that he cannot. I go there every time something is really bothering me, and I just share my burdens with him.
Besides finding a place of refuge, there are so many other ways to renew yourself and build your PBA. Exercise can do it, like going for a walk, running, dancing, or punching a bag. Some teens have suggested watching old movies, playing a musical instrument, finger painting, or talking to friends who uplift you. Numerous others have found that writing in their journals does wonders to help them cope. Habit 7, Sharpen the Saw, is all about taking time to renew your body, heart, mind, and soul. We'll talk more about it when we get there, so hold your horses. Tap into your talents. Finding and then developing a talent, a hobby, or special interest can be one of the single greatest deposits you can make into your PBA. Why is it that when we think of talents, we think in terms of the traditional high-profile talents, such as the athlete, or the dancer, or award-winning scholar? The truth is, talents come in a variety of packages. Don't think small. You may have a knack for reading, or writing, or speaking. You may have a gift for being creative, being a fast learner, or being accepting of other people. You may have organizational, music, or leadership skills. It doesn't really matter where your talent may lie, whether it's in chess, drama, or butterfly collecting. When you do something you like doing and have a talent for it, it's exhilarating. It's a form of self-expression, and as this girl attests, it builds esteem.
You might die laughing when I tell you that I have a real talent and love for weeds. I'm not talking about the kind you smoke, but weeds and flowers that grow everywhere. I realized that I always noticed them, while others wanted them cut down. So I started picking them and pressing them, and eventually making beautiful pictures and postcards and art objects with them. I have been able to cheer up many sad souls with one of my personalized cards. I am often asked to do arrangements of flowers for others and to share my knowledge of preserving pressed plants. It's given me so much joy and confidence. Just knowing I have a special gift and appreciation for something most people ignore. It goes beyond that. It's taught me that if there is so much to just simple weeds, how much more is there to almost everything else in life? It's made me look deeper. It makes me explore. And I actually am just a normal young girl.
My brother-in-law, Bryce, told me how developing a talent helped build his self-confidence and find a career in which you could make a difference. His story is set in the Teton Mountain Range that stretches high above the plains of Idaho and Wyoming. The Grand Teton, the tallest of the Teton peaks, jets 13,776 feet above sea level. As a young boy, Bryce had the picture-perfect baseball swing, until his tragic accident. While playing with a BB gun one day, Bryce accidentally shot himself in the eye. Fearing that surgery might permanently impair his vision, the doctors left the BB in his eye. Months later, when Bryce returned to baseball, he began striking out each time at bat. He had lost his depth perception and much of his vision in one eye and could no longer judge the ball. Said Bryce, "I was an all-star player the year before and now I couldn't even hit the ball. I was convinced that I would never be able to do anything again. It was a big blow to my confidence." Bryce's two older brothers were good at so many things and he wondered what he could do now, given his new handicap. Since he lived near the Tetons, he decided to give climbing a try. So he dropped by the local army store and bought nylon rope, carabiners, chocks, pitons, and other climbing necessities. He checked out climbing books and studied how to tie knots, how to hook up a harness, and rappel. His first real climbing experience was rappelling off his friend's chimney. Soon he began climbing some of the smallest peaks surrounding the Grand Teton. Bryce soon realized that he had a knack for it. And like many of his climbing partners, his body was strong and lightweight and seemed to be perfectly built for rock climbing. After training for several months, Bryce finally climbed the Grand Teton all by himself. It took him 2 days. Reaching this goal was a great confidence builder. Climbing partners were hard to come by, so Bryce began training on his own. He would drive to the Tetons, run up to the base of the climb, do the climb, and run back down. He did this so often he became very good at it. One day, a friend of his, named Kim, said, "Hey, you gotta go after the record on the Grand Teton." He told Bryce all about it. A climbing ranger named Jock Glidden had set a record on the Grand by running to the top and back in 4 hours and 11 minutes. "That's absolutely impossible," thought Bryce. "I'd like to meet this guy someday." But as Bryce continued to do these types of runs, his times became faster, and Kim kept saying, "You need to go after the record. I know you could do it." On one occasion, Bryce finally met Jock, the superhuman with the insurmountable record. Bryce and Kim were sitting in Jock's tent when Kim, a well-known climber himself, said to Jock, "Hey, this guy here is thinking about going after your record." Jock gazed at Bryce's 125-pound body and laughed aloud, as if to say, "Get a clue, you little runt." Bryce felt devastated, but quickly gathered himself, and Kim kept affirming him, "You can do it. I know you can do it." Early in the morning on August 26, 1981, carrying a small orange backpack and a light jacket, Bryce ran to the top of the Grand and back in 3 hours, 47 minutes and 4 seconds. He stopped only twice, once to take rocks out of his shoes and once to sign the register at the summit to prove he had been there. He felt marvelous. He had actually broken the record. A few years later, Bryce received a surprise call from Kim. "Bryce, have you heard? Your record has just been broken." Of course, he added, you need to get it back. I know you can do it. A man named Creighton King, who had recently won the heralded Pikes Peak Marathon in Colorado, dashed to the top and back in 3 hours, 30 minutes, and 9 seconds. On August 26, 1983, 2 years after his last assault on the mountain, and 10 days after his record had been broken, Bryce stood in the Lupine Meadows parking lot at the base of the Grand Teton in brand new running shoes, ready and eager to break King's record. With him were friends, his family, Kim, and a crew from the local television station to film his run. As before, he knew the hardest part of the climb would be the mental aspect. He didn't want to become one of the two or three who die each year while attempting to climb the Grand. Sports writer Russell Weeks describes running the Grand as follows. From the parking lot, you face a run of about 9 or 10 miles up switchback trails, through a canyon, up two glacial moraines, two saddles, a gap between two peaks, and a 700-foot climb up the west wall of the Grand to the top. The rise and fall in altitude from Lupine Meadows to the top and back is about 15,000 feet. Lee Ortenberger's Climber's Guide to the Teton Range lists the last 700 feet alone as a 3-hour climb. Bryce took off running. As he ascended up, up, up the mountain, his heart pounded and his legs burned. Concentration was intense. Scaling the last 700 feet in 12 minutes, he reached the summit in 1 hour and 53 minutes and placed his verification card under a rock. He knew that if he were to break King's record, he would have to do it coming down. The descent became so steep at times that he was taking 10 to 15 foot strides. He passed some friends who later told him his face had turned purple from oxygen depletion. Another climbing party apparently knew he was going for the record because as he passed, he yelled, "Go, go!" Amid cheers, Bryce returned to Lupine Meadows with bleeding knees, thrashed tennis shoes, and one horrific headache, 3 hours, 6 minutes, and 25 seconds after he had left. He had done the impossible. Word spread fast, and Bryce became known as the best mountain climber around. "It gave me an identity," said Bryce. "Everyone wants to be known for something, and so did I. My ability to climb gave me something to work for and was a great source of self-esteem. It was my way of expressing myself." Today, Bryce is founder and president of a very successful company that makes high-performance backpacks for climbers and mountain runners. Most important, Bryce is making a living doing what he loves to do and what he is good at, and has used his talent to bless his life and the lives of many others. Oh, by the way, the record still stands, if you can believe it. Now, don't get any wild ideas. And Bryce, incidentally, still has that BB in his eye. So, my friends, if you need a shot of confidence, start making some deposits into your PBA starting today. You'll feel the results instantly. And remember, you don't have to climb a mountain to make a deposit. There are a million and one safer ways. Coming attractions. Up ahead, we'll talk about the many ways in which you and your dog are different. Read on and you'll see what I mean.
Baby steps number one. Keep promises to yourself. Get up when you plan to for 3 days in a row.
Number two, identify one easy task that needs to be done today, like put in batch of laundry or read a book for an English assignment. Decide when to do it, now keep your word and get it done.
Do random acts of service. Baby steps number three. Sometime today, do a kind anonymous deed, like writing a thank you note, taking out the trash, or making someone's bed.
Number four, look around and find something you can do to make a difference, like cleaning up a park in your neighborhood, volunteering in a senior citizen center, or reading to someone who can't.
Tap into your talents. Baby steps number five. List a talent you would like to develop this year. Write down specific steps to get there.
Number six, make a list of talents you most admire in other people.
Number seven, think about an area of life you feel inferior in. Now breathe deeply and tell yourself it's not the end of the world.
Number eight, try to go an entire day without negative self-talk. Each time you catch yourself putting yourself down, you have to replace it with three positive thoughts about yourself.
Renew yourself. Baby steps number nine. Decide on a fun activity that will lift your spirits and do it today. For example, turn up the music and dance.
Number 10. Feeling lethargic? Get up right now and go for a fast walk around the block.
Be honest. Baby steps number 11. The next time your parents ask you about what you're doing, share the complete story. Don't leave out information meant to mislead or deceive.
Number 12. For one day, try not to exaggerate or embellish.
Habit 1. Be proactive.
I am the force. Growing up in my home was at times a big pain. Why? Because my dad always made me take responsibility for everything in my life. Whenever I said something like, "Dad, my girlfriend makes me so mad," without fail, Dad would come back with, "Now come on, Sean. No one can make you mad unless you let them. It's your choice. You choose to be mad." Or if I said, "My new biology teacher stinks. I'm never going to learn a thing," Dad would say, "Why don't you go to your teacher and give him some suggestions? Change teachers. Get a tutor if you have to. If you don't learn biology, Sean, it's your own fault, not your teacher's." He never let me off the hook. He was always challenging me, making sure that I never blamed someone else for the way I acted. Luckily, my mom let me blame other people and things for my problems, or I might have turned out psycho. I often scream back, "You're wrong, Dad. I didn't choose to be mad. She made me mad. Just get off my back and leave me alone." You see, Dad's idea that you are responsible for your life was hard medicine for me to swallow as a teenager. But with hindsight, I see the wisdom in what he was doing. He wanted me to learn that there are two types of people in this world, the proactive and the reactive. Those who take responsibility for their lives and those who blame. Those who make it happen and those who get happened to. Habit 1, be proactive, is the key to unlocking all the other habits, and that's why it comes first. Habit 1 says, "I am the force. I am the captain of my life. I can choose my attitude. I'm responsible for my own happiness or unhappiness. I am in the driver's seat of my destiny, not just a passenger." Being proactive is the first step toward achieving the private victory. Can you imagine doing algebra before learning addition and subtraction? Not going to happen. The same goes for the 7 habits. You can't do habits 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, and 7 before doing habit 1. That's because until you feel you are in charge of your own life, nothing else is really possible. Now, is it? Proactive or reactive, the choice is yours. Each day, you and I have about 100 chances to choose whether to be proactive or reactive. In any given day, the weather is bad, you can't find a job, your sister steals your blouse, you lose an election at school, your friends talk behind your back, someone calls you names, your parents don't let you take the car for no reason, you get a parking ticket on campus, and you flunk a test. So what are you going to do about it? Are you in the habit of reacting to these kinds of everyday things? Or are you proactive? The choice is yours. It really is. You don't have to respond the way everyone else does or the way people think you should. How many times have you been driving down the road when suddenly somebody cuts in front of you, making you slam on your brakes? What do you do? Do you fly off at the mouth, give them the bird, let it ruin your day, lose bladder control? Or do you just let it go, laugh about it, move on? The choice is yours. Reactive people make choices based on impulse. They are like a can of soda pop. If life shakes them up a bit, the pressure builds and then they suddenly explode. "Hey, you stupid jerk! Get out of my lane!" Proactive people make choices based on values. They think before they act. They recognize that they can't control everything that happens to them, but they can control what they do about it. Unlike reactive people who are full of carbonation, proactive people are like water. Shake them up all you want, take off the lid, and nothing. No fizzing, no bubbling, no pressure. They are calm, cool, and in control. "I'm not going to let that guy get me upset and ruin my day." A great way to understand the proactive mindset is to compare proactive and reactive responses to situations that happen all the time. Here we go. Scene 1. You overhear your best friend bad-mouthing you in front of a group. She doesn't know you overheard the conversation. Just 5 minutes ago, this same friend was sweet-talking you to your face. You feel hurt and betrayed. Here are some reactive choices. Tell her off, then hit her. Go into a deep depression because you feel so bad about what she said. Decide that she's a two-faced liar and give her the silent treatment for 2 months. Spread vicious rumors about her. After all, she did it to you. Proactive choices. Here are some proactive choices. Forgive her.
confront her and calmly share how you feel about what happened. Ignore it and give her a second chance. Realize that she has weaknesses just like you and that occasionally you talk behind her back without really meaning any harm. Scene 2. You've been working at your job in the store for over a year now and have been extremely committed and dependable. 3 months ago, a new employee joined the crew. Recently, he was given the coveted Saturday afternoon shift, the shift you were hoping for. Reactive choices. Spend half your waking hours complaining to everyone and their dog about how unfair this decision was. Scrutinize the new employee and find his every weakness. Become convinced your supervisor has formed a conspiracy and is out to get you. Begin to slack off while working your shift. Here are some proactive choices. Talk with your supervisor about why the new employee got the better shift. Continue to be a hard-working employee. Learn what you can do to improve your performance. If you determine you are in a dead-end job, begin looking for a new one. Listen to your language. You can usually hear the difference between proactive and reactive people by the type of language they use. Reactive language usually sounds like this. That's me. That's just the way I am. What they're really saying is, I'm not responsible for the way I act. I can't change. I was predetermined to be this way. If my boss wasn't such a jerk, things would be different. What they're really saying is, my boss is the cause of all my problems, not me. Here's another one. Thanks a lot. You just ruined my entire day. What they're really saying is, I'm not in control of my own moods. You are. Or here's another one. If only I attended a different school, or had better friends, or made more money, lived in a different apartment, had a boyfriend, then I'd be happy. What they're really saying is, I'm not in control of my own happiness. Things are. I must have things to be happy. Notice that reactive language takes power away from you and gives it to something or someone else. As my friend John Bytheway explains in his book, What I Wish I'd Known in High School, when you're reactive, it's like giving someone else the remote control to your life and saying, Here, change my mood anytime you wish. Proactive language, on the other hand, puts the remote control back into your own hands. You are then free to choose which channel you want to be on. Let's compare reactive and proactive language. Reactive language, I'll try. Proactive, I'll do it. Reactive language, that's just the way I am. Proactive, I can do better than that. Reactive, there's nothing I can do. Proactive, let's look at all of our options. Reactive, I have to. Proactive, I choose to. Reactive, I can't. Proactive, there's gotta be a way. Reactive language, you ruined my day. Proactive language, I'm not gonna let your bad mood rub off on me. The victimitis virus. Some people suffer from a contagious virus I call victimitis. Perhaps you've seen it. People infected with victimitis believe that everyone has it in for them, and that the world owes them something, which isn't the case at all. I like the way author Mark Twain put it. Don't go around saying the world owes you a living. The world owes you nothing. It was here first. I played college football with a guy who, unfortunately, became infected. His comments drove me crazy. He'd say things like, I would be starting, but the coaches have something against me. Or, I was about to intercept the ball, but somebody cut me off. Or, I would have gotten a better 40-yard dash time, but my shoes came loose while I was running. Yeah, sure, I always felt like saying. And I'd be president if my dad weren't bald. To me, it was little wonder that he never played. In his mind, the problem was always out there. He never considered that perhaps his attitude was the problem. Besides feeling like victims, reactive people are easily offended, blame others, get angry and say things they later regret. They whine and complain, wait for things to happen to them, and they change only when they have to. It pays to be proactive. Proactive people are a different breed. Proactive people are not easily offended. They take responsibility for their choices.
They think before they act. They bounce back when something bad happens. They always find a way to make it happen. And they focus on things they can do something about and don't worry about things they can't. I remember starting a new job and working with a guy named Randy. I don't know what his problem was, but for some reason Randy didn't like me and he wanted me to know it. He'd say rude things and insulting things to me. He was constantly talking behind my back and getting others to side with him against me. I remember returning from a vacation one time and a friend telling me, "Boy, Sean, if you only knew what Randy has been saying about you, you'd better watch your back." There were times I wanted to pound the guy, but somehow I managed to keep my cool and ignore his silly attacks. Whenever he insulted me, I made it a personal challenge to treat him well in return. I had faith that things would work out in the end if I acted this way. In a matter of a few months, things began to change. Randy could see that I wasn't going to play the game and began to lighten up. He even told me one time, "Sean, I've tried to offend you, but you won't take offense." After being at the company for about a year, we became friends and gained respect for each other. Had I reacted to his attacks, which was my feline instinct, I'm certain we wouldn't be friends today. Often all it takes is one person to create a friendship. Mary Beth discovered for herself the benefits of being proactive.
I had taken a class at school where we had talked about proactivity, and I wondered about how to really apply it. One day, as I was checking groceries for a guy, he suddenly told me that the groceries I had just rung up weren't his. My first reaction was to say, "You idiot," then put the bar down between the other customers' groceries. Why didn't you stop me sooner? So I have to delete it all and call to get the changes approved by a supervisor, while he just stands there and thinks it's funny. Meanwhile, the air is rising and I'm getting real irritated. To top it off, then he has the nerve to question the price I charged him for the broccoli. To my horror, I discovered that he was right. I'd put the wrong code numbers in the register for the broccoli. Now I was extra irritated and so tempted to lash out at him to cover for my own mistake. But then this idea popped into my mind. Be proactive. So I said, "You're right, sir. It's completely my fault. I will correct the pricing. It'll just take a couple of seconds." I also remembered that being proactive doesn't mean you're a doormat. So I reminded him nicely that to avoid this kind of thing in the future, he would need to always put the bar down that separates orders. It felt so good. I had apologized, but I had also said what I wanted to say. It was such a simple thing, but it gave me such inner conversion and confidence in this habit.
At this point, you're probably ready to shoot me and say, "Now come on, Sean, it's not that easy." I won't argue with you. Being reactive is so much easier. It's easy to lose your cool. That doesn't take any control. And it's easy to whine and complain. Without question, being proactive is the higher road. But remember, you don't have to be perfect. In reality, you and I aren't either completely proactive or reactive, but probably somewhere in between. The key then is to get in the habit of being proactive so you can run on autopilot and not even have to think about it. If you're choosing to be proactive 20 out of 100 times on average each day, try doing it 30 out of 100 times, then 40. Never underestimate the huge difference small changes can make. We can control only one thing. The fact is, we can't control everything that happens to us. We can't control the color of our skin, who will win the NBA Finals, where we were born, who our parents are, how much tuition will be next fall, or how others might treat us. But there is one thing we can control, how we respond to what happens to us. And that is what counts. This is why we need to stop worrying about things we can't control and start worrying about things we can. Picture two circles. The inner circle is our circle of control. It includes things we have control over, such as ourselves, our attitudes, our choices, our response to whatever happens to us. Surrounding the circle of control is the circle of no control. It includes the thousands of things we can't do anything about. Now, what will happen if we spend our time and energy worrying about things we can't control, like a rude comment, a past mistake, or the weather? You guessed it. We'll feel even more out of control, as if we were victims. For instance, if your sister bugs you and you're always complaining about her weaknesses, something you have no control over, that won't do anything to fix the problem.
it will only cause you to blame your problems on her and lose power yourself. Renata told me a story that illustrates this point. A week before her upcoming volleyball game, Renata learned that the mother of a player on the opposing team had made fun of Renata's volleyball skills. Instead of ignoring the comments, Renata became angry and spent the rest of the week stewing about it. When the game arrived, her only goal was to prove to this mother that she was a good player. To make a long story short, Renata played poorly, spent much of her time on the bench, and her team lost the game. She was so focused on something she couldn't control, what was said about her, that she lost control of the only thing she could, herself. Proactive people, on the other hand, focus elsewhere, on the things they can control. By doing so, they experience inner peace and gain more control of their lives. They learn to smile about and live with the many things they can't do anything about. They may not like them, but they know it's no use worrying. Turning setbacks into triumphs. Life often deals us a bad hand, and it is up to us to control how we respond. Every time we have a setback, it's an opportunity for us to turn it into a triumph, as this account by Brad Lemley from Parade Magazine illustrates. Quote, "It's not what happens to you in life, it's what you do about it," unquote. Or so says W. Mitchell, a self-made millionaire, a sought-after speaker, a former mayor, a river rafter, and a skydiver. And he accomplished all of this after his accidents. If you saw Mitchell, you'd find this hard to believe. You see, this guy's face is a patchwork of multicolored skin grafts. The fingers of both his hands are either missing or mere stubs, and his paralyzed legs lie thin and useless under his slacks. Mitchell says sometimes people try to guess how he was injured. Was it a car wreck? Vietnam? The real story is more astounding than one could ever imagine. On June 19, 1971, he was on top of the world. The day before, he had bought a beautiful new motorcycle. That morning, he soloed in an airplane for the first time. He was young, healthy, and popular. "That afternoon, I got on that motorcycle to ride to work," he recalls, "and at the intersection, a laundry truck and I collided. The bike went down, crushed my elbow, and fractured my pelvis, and the gas can popped open on the motorcycle. The gas poured out, the heat of the engine ignited it, and I got burned over 65% of my body. Fortunately, a quick-thinking man in a nearby car lot doused Mitchell with a fire extinguisher and saved his life. Even so, Mitchell's face had been burned off. His fingers were black, charred, and twisted. His legs were nothing but raw red flesh. It was common for first-time visitors to look at him and faint. He was unconscious for 2 weeks, and then he awakened. Over 4 months, he had 13 transfusions, 16 skin graft operations, and several other surgeries. 4 years later, after spending months in rehab and years learning to adapt to his new handicaps, the unthinkable happened. Mitchell was involved in a freak airplane crash and was paralyzed from the waist down. "When I tell people there were two separate accidents," he says, "they can hardly stand it." After his paralyzing plane crash accident, Mitchell recalls meeting a 19-year-old patient in the hospital's gymnasium. Quote, "This guy had also been paralyzed. He had been a mountain climber, a skier, an active outdoors person, and he was convinced his life was over. Finally, I went over to this guy and I said, 'You know something? Before all this happened to me, there were 10,000 things I could do. Now there are 9,000. I could spend the rest of my life dwelling on the 1,000 that I lost, but I choose to focus on the 9,000 that are left.'" Mitchell says his secret is twofold. First is the love and encouragement of friends and family, and second is a personal philosophy he has gleaned from various sources. He realized he did not have to buy society's notion that one must be handsome and healthy to be happy. "I am in charge of my own spaceship," he states emphatically. "It is my up, my down. I could choose to see the situation as a setback or a starting point." I like how Helen Keller put it. "So much has been given to me, I have no time to ponder that which has been denied." Although most of our setbacks won't be as severe as Mitchell's, all of us will have our fair share. You might get dumped by a girlfriend, you might lose an election at school, you may get beaten up by a gang, you may not get accepted to the school of your choice, or you may become seriously ill. I hope and believe that you will be proactive and strong in these defining moments. I remember a major setback of my own 2 years after I became the starting quarterback in college. I seriously injured my knee, fell behind, and subsequently lost my position. I vividly recall a coach calling me into his office just before the season began and telling me they were handing the starting job to somebody else. I felt sick. I'd worked my whole life to get to this position. It was my senior year. This wasn't supposed to happen. Well, as a backup, I had a choice to make. I could complain, badmouth the new guy, and feel sorry for myself, or I could make the most of the situation. Luckily, I decided to deal with it. I was no longer throwing touchdowns, but I could help in other ways. So I swallowed my pride and began supporting the new guy and the rest of the team. I worked hard and prepared myself for each game as if I were the starter, and, more significant, I chose to keep my chin up. Was it easy? Not at all. I often felt like a failure. Sitting out every game after being the starter was humiliating, and keeping a good attitude was a constant struggle. Was it the right choice? Definitely. Even though I wore out my bum on the bench all year, I contributed to the team in other ways. Most important, I took responsibility for my attitude. I cannot begin to tell you what a positive difference this singular decision made in my life. Rising above abuse. One of the hardest setbacks of all is coping with abuse. I'll never forget the morning I spent with a group of teens who had been sexually abused as children, were victims of date rape, or were otherwise abused emotionally or physically. Heather told me this story.
I was sexually abused at 14. It happened when I was at a fair. A boy from school came up to me and said, "I really need to talk to you. Come with me for a few minutes." I never suspected anything because this kid was my friend and had always been really nice to me. He took me on a long walk and we ended up down at the dugouts at the high school. That was where he forced me and raped me. He kept telling me, "If you tell anyone, no one will believe you. You wanted this to happen to you anyway." He also told me that my parents would be so ashamed of me. I kept quiet about it for 2 years. Finally, I was attending a help session where people who were abused told their stories, and this one girl got up and told a story similar to mine. When she said the name of the boy that abused her, I started to cry because it was the same one who had raped me. It turned out that there were 6 of us who were victimized by him.
Fortunately, Heather is now on the road to recovery and has found tremendous strength in being part of a teen group that is trying to help other abuse victims. By coming forward, she has also put a stop to more people being hurt by the same boy. Bridget's story, unfortunately, is very common.
At the age of 5, I was sexually abused by a family member. Too afraid to tell anyone, I tried to bury my hurt and anger. Now that I have come to terms with what happened, I look back on my life and can see how it has affected everything. In trying to hide something terrible, I ended up hiding myself. It wasn't until 13 years later that I finally confronted my childhood nightmare. Many people have been through the same experience as I have, or something that is related. Most hide it. Why? Some are afraid for their lives. Others want to protect themselves or someone else. But whatever the reason, hiding isn't the answer. It only leaves a cut so deep in the soul that it seems there's no way of healing it. Confronting it is the only way to sew up the bleeding gash. Find someone to talk to, someone you feel comfortable with, someone you can trust. It is a long and difficult process, but once you come to terms with it, it's only then that you can start to live.
If you have been abused, it's not your fault, and the truth has to be told. Abuse thrives in secrecy. By telling another person, you immediately divide your problem in half. Talk with a loved one or a friend you can trust. Take part in a help session or visit a professional therapist. If the first person you share your troubles with isn't receptive, don't give up. Keep sharing until you find someone who is. Sharing your secret with another is an important step in the healing and forgiving process. Be proactive. Take the initiative to do it. You don't need to live with this burden for one day longer. Becoming a change agent. I once asked a group of teens, "Who are your role models?" One girl mentioned her mother. Another kid talked about his brother, and so on. One guy was noticeably silent. I asked him whom he admired, and he said quietly, "I don't really have a role model." All he wanted to do was make sure he didn't turn out like the people who should have been his role models. Unfortunately, this is the case with many teens. They come from messed up families and may not have anyone to pattern their lives after. The scary thing is that bad habits such as abuse, alcoholism, and welfare dependency are often passed down from parents to kids, and as a result, dysfunctional families keep repeating themselves. For example, if you have been abused as a child, the statistics show that you are likely to become an abuser as well. Sometimes these problems go back for generations. You may come from a long line of alcohol or drug abusers. You may come from a long line of dependency on welfare. Perhaps no one in your family has ever graduated from college or even high school. The good news is that you can stop the cycle. Because you are proactive, you can stop these bad habits from being passed on. You can become a change agent and pass on good habits to future generations, starting with your own kids. A tenacious young girl named Hilda shared with me how she became a change agent in her family. Education was never valued in her home, and Hilda could see the consequences of it. Says Hilda, quote, "My mom worked in a factory sewing for very little money, and my father worked for slightly over minimum wage. I would hear them arguing over the money and how they were going to pay the rent. The highest grade my parents went to in school was the sixth grade." End of quote. As a young girl, Hilda vividly remembers her dad being unable to help her with her homework because he couldn't read English. This was hard on her. When Hilda was in junior high, her family moved from California back to Mexico. Hilda soon realized that there were limited educational options for her there, so she asked if she could move back to the States to live with her aunt. For the next several years, Hilda made great sacrifices to stay in school. "It was hard to be crowded into a room with my cousin," she says, "and have to share a bed and work to pay them rent as well as go to school, but it was worth it. Even though I had a kid and got married in high school, I kept going to school and working toward finishing my education. I wanted to prove to my dad that no matter what, he was wrong when he said no one in our family could become a professional." Hilda will soon be graduating with a university degree in finance. She wants her educational values to be passed on to her kids. Says Hilda, "Today, every time I can, when I am not in school, I sit on the sofa and I read to my son. I am teaching him how to speak English and Spanish. I am trying to save money for his education. One day, he will need help with his homework, and I will be there to help him read it." I interviewed another 16-year-old boy named Shane from the Midwest who is also becoming a change agent in his family. Shane lives with his parents and two siblings in a poor section of town called The Projects. Although his parents are still together, they're constantly fighting and accusing each other of having affairs. His dad drives a truck and is never home. His mom smokes weed with his 12-year-old sister. His older brother failed 2 years of high school and finally dropped out. At one point, Shane lost hope. Just when he'd thought he had hit rock bottom, he got involved in a character development class at school that taught the 7 habits, and he began to see that there were things he could do to seize control of his life and create a future for himself. Fortunately, Shane's grandfather owned the upstairs apartment where Shane's family lived, so Shane paid him $100 a month rent, and he moved to that apartment. He now has his own sanctuary and is able to block out everything he doesn't want to be part of on the floor below. Says Shane, "Things have gotten better now for me. I treat myself better and I show myself respect. My family doesn't have very much respect for themselves. Although nobody in my family has ever gone to college, I have been accepted to 3 different universities. Everything I do now is for my future. My future is going to be different. I know I won't sit down with my 12-year-old daughter and smoke weed." End of quote. You have the power within you to rise above whatever may have been passed down to you. You may not have the option of moving upstairs to escape from it all, as Shane did, but you can figuratively move upstairs in your own mind. No matter how bad your predicament is, you can become a change agent and create a new life for yourself and whatever may follow. Growing your proactive muscles. The following poem is a great summary of what it means to take responsibility for one's life and how a person can gradually move from a reactive to a proactive frame of mind. Autobiography in 5 short chapters. From There's a Hole in My Sidewalk by Portia Nelson. Chapter 1. I walk down the street. There is a deep hole in the sidewalk. I fall in. I am lost. I am helpless. It isn't my fault. It takes forever to find a way out. Chapter 2. I walk down the same street. There is a deep hole in the sidewalk. I pretend I don't see it. I fall in again. I can't believe I am in the same place. But it isn't my fault. It still takes a long time to get out. Chapter 3. I walk down the same street. There is a deep hole in the sidewalk. I see it is there. I still fall in. It's a habit. My eyes are open. I know where I am. It is my fault. I get out immediately. Chapter 4. I walk down the same street. There is a deep hole in the sidewalk. I walk around it. Chapter 5. I walk down another street. You too can take responsibility for your life and stay away from potholes by flexing your proactive muscles. It's a breakthrough habit that will save your bacon more than you could ever imagine. Can do. Being proactive really means two things. First, you take responsibility for your life. Second, you have a can-do attitude. Can-do is very different from no-can-do. Just take a peek. Can-do people take initiative to make it happen. No-can-do people wait for something to happen to them. Can-do people think about solutions and options. No-can-do people think about problems and barriers. Can-do people act. Well, no-can-do people are acted upon. If you think can-do and you're creative and persistent, it's amazing what you can accomplish. During college, I remember being told that to fulfill my language requirement, I would have to take a class that I had no interest in and was meaningless to me. Instead of taking this class, however, I decided to create my own. So I put together a list of books I would read and the assignments I would do, and then I found a teacher to sponsor me. I then went to the dean of the school and presented my case. He bought into the idea, and I completed my language requirement by taking my self-built course. American aviator Eleanor Smith once said, "It has long since come to my attention that people of accomplishment rarely sat back and let things happen to them. They went out and happened to things." It's so true. To reach your goals in life, you must seize the initiative. If you're feeling bad about not being asked out on dates, don't just sit around and sulk. Do something about it. Find ways to meet people. Be friendly and try smiling a lot. Ask them out. They may not know how great you are. Don't wait for that perfect job to fall in your lap. Go after it. Send out your resume, network, or volunteer to work for free. If you're at a store and need assistance, don't wait for the salesperson to find you. You find them. Some people mistake can-do for being pushy, aggressive, or obnoxious. Wrong. Can-do is courageous, persistent, and smart. Others think that can-do people stretch the rules and make their own laws. Not so. Can-do thinkers are creative, enterprising, and extremely resourceful. Pia, a work associate of mine, shared the following story. Although it took place a long time ago, the principle of can-do is still the same.
I was a young journalist in a big city in Europe, working full-time as a reporter for United Press International. I was inexperienced and always nervous that I wouldn't be able to live up to the expectations of a tough and much older male press crew. The Beatles were coming to town, and to my utter amazement, I was appointed to cover their stay. My editor didn't realize how big they were. They were the hottest thing in Europe in those days. Girls fainted by the hundreds just by their presence, and here I was going to cover their press conference. The press conference was exciting, and I was elated to be there, but I realized that everyone would have the same story. I needed something more, something meaty, something that would really make front page. I just couldn't waste this opportunity. One by one, all the experienced reporters went back to their papers to report, and the Beatles went up to their rooms. I stayed behind. I've got to figure out a way to get to these guys, I thought, and there's no time to lose. I walked to the hotel lobby, picked up the house phone, and dialed the penthouse. I guessed that that's where they'd be staying. Their manager answered, "This is Pia Jensen from United Press International. I would like to come talk to the Beatles," I said confidently. "What did I have to lose?" To my amazement, he said, "Come on up." Trembling and feeling like I had hit the jackpot, I entered the elevator and went up to the royal suites of the hotel. I was led into an area as big as an entire floor, and here they all sat, Ringo, Paul, John, and George. I gulped down my nervousness and inexperience and tried to act like a world-class reporter. I spent the next 2 hours laughing, listening, talking, writing, and having the best time of my life. They treated me royally and gave me all of the attention in the world. My story was splashed on the front page of the leading newspaper in that country the next morning. And my more extended interviews with each of the Beatles appeared as a feature in most of the newspapers of the world within the very next few days. When the Rolling Stones came to town after that, guess who they sent? Me, a young female, inexperienced reporter. I used the same approach with them, and it worked again. I soon realized what I could accomplish by being pleasantly persistent. A pattern was set in my mind, and I was convinced anything was possible. With this approach, I usually got the best story, and my news career took on a whole new dimension.
George Bernard Shaw, the English playwright, knew all about can-do. Listen to how he said it. People are always blaming their circumstances for what they are. I don't believe in circumstances. The people who get on in this world are the people who get up and look for the circumstances they want. And if they can't find them, make them. Pay attention to how Denise was able to create the circumstances she wanted.
I know it's strange for a teenager to want to work in a library, but I really wanted that job, more than I had ever wanted anything, but they weren't hiring. I went to the library to read, hang out with my friends, and just get away from home. What better place to work than someplace I already hung out at? Although I didn't have a job there, I got to know the office staff, and I volunteered for special events, and pretty soon, I was one of the regulars. It paid off. When they finally had an opening, I was their first choice. I found one of the best jobs I ever had.
Just push pause. So when someone is rude to you, where do you get the power to resist being rude back? For starters, just push pause. Yep, just reach up and push the pause button to your life, just as you would on your remote control. If I remember right, the pause button is found somewhere in the middle of your forehead. Sometimes life is moving so fast that we instantly react to everything out of sheer habit. If you can learn to pause, get control, and think about how you want to respond, you'll make smarter decisions. Yes, your childhood, your parents, your genes, and your environment influence you to act in certain ways, but they can't make you do anything. You are not determined, but are free to choose. While your life is on pause, open up your toolbox, the one that you were born with, and use your four human tools to help you decide what to do. Animals don't have these tools, and that's why you're smarter than your dog. These tools are self-awareness, conscience, imagination, and willpower. You might want to call them your power tools. Self-awareness says this: I can stand apart from myself and observe my thoughts and actions. Conscience says this: I can listen to my inner voice to know right from wrong. Imagination says this: I can envision new possibilities. And willpower says this: I have the power to choose. Let's illustrate these tools by imagining a team named Rosa and her dog Woof as they go for a walk. "Here, boy, what say we go outside?" says Rosa, as Woof leaps up and down, wagging his tail. It's been a rough week for Rosa. Not only has she just broken up with her boyfriend, Eric, but she and her mom are barely on speaking terms. As she strolls down the sidewalk, Rosa begins thinking about the past week. "You know what?" she muses to herself. "Breaking up with Eric has really been tough on me. It's probably why I've been so rude to my mom and taking out all my frustrations on her." You see what Rosa is doing? She's standing apart from herself and evaluating and measuring her actions. This process is called self-awareness. It's a tool that is native to all humanoids. By using her self-awareness, Rosa is able to recognize that she's allowing her breakup with Eric to affect her relationship with her mom. This observation is the first step to changing the way she has been treating her mother. Meanwhile, Woof sees a cat up ahead and instinctively takes off in a frenzy after it. Although Woof is a loyal dog, he is completely unaware of himself. He doesn't even know that he is a dog. He is incapable of standing apart from himself and saying, "You know what? Ever since Susie, his dog friend next door, moved, I've been taking out my anger on all the neighborhood cats." As she continues her stroll, Rosa's thoughts begin to wander. She can hardly wait for the school concert tomorrow when she will be performing a solo. Music is her life. Rosa imagines herself singing at the concert. She sees herself dazzling the audience, then bowing to receive a rousing standing ovation from all of her friends and teachers, and of course all the cute guys. In this scene, Rosa is using another one of her human tools, imagination. It is a remarkable gift. It allows us to escape our present circumstances and create new possibilities in our heads. It gives us a chance to visualize our futures and dream up what we would like to become. While Rosa is imagining visions of grandeur, Woof is busily digging up the earth trying to get at a worm. You see, Woof's imagination is about as live as a rock. Zilch. He can't even think beyond the moment. He can't envision new possibilities. Can you imagine Woof thinking, "Someday, I'm gonna make Lassie look like chopped liver." "Hi, Rosa. What you doing?" says Heidi, pulling up alongside Rosa in her car. "Oh, hello, Heidi," replies the startled Rosa as she brings her thoughts back to Earth. "You surprise me. I'm just taking Woof for a walk." "Hey, I heard about you and Eric. What a bummer." Rosa is bothered by Heidi's reference to Eric. It's none of her business, really. Although she is tempted to be curt with Heidi, she knows that Heidi is new at school and desperately in need of friends. Rosa feels that being warm and friendly is the right thing to do. "Yeah, breaking up with Eric has been tough, so how are things with you, Heidi?" Rosa has just used her human tool called conscience. A conscience is an inner voice that will always teach us right from wrong. Each of us has a conscience, and it will either grow or shrink depending upon whether or not we follow its promptings. Meanwhile, Woof is relieving himself on Mr. Newman's newly painted white picket fence. You see, Woof has absolutely no moral sense of right and wrong. After all, he is just a dog, and dogs will do whatever their instincts compel them to do. Rosa's walk with Woof comes to an end. As she opens the front door to her house, she hears her mom yell from the other room, "Rosa, just where have you been? I've been looking all over for you." Rosa has already made up her mind not to lose her cool with her mom. So, despite wanting to yell back, "Get out of my face," she responds calmly, "Oh, just out for a walk with Woof, Mom." "Woof, Woof, come back here," screams Rosa, as Woof darts out the open door to chase a local paperboy on his bike. While Rosa is using her four